WNST, Towson Baltimore, and Baltimore Positive. This one's going to be a really, really juicy one. We talk about keeping calm, staying local, nothing more local than this. And our sponsors, of course, Don Moeller joining us for this segment of Baltimore Positive. Of course, he's right down the road from State Fair, and our friends with the chicken and the waffles and the shrimp and the grits and all the good stuff that Evan brings curbside now. You call ahead. Still got to get over there and get some of those delicious wings. I want to bring those home next time I drop by and wave to Don from 7 feet away. We'll do that. Downtown Fadley still delivering those crab cakes everywhere in the world. And I know this particular segment, I would have preferred to be doing this downtown at Fadley's with Ron Cassie, senior editor at Baltimore Magazine. And before we get to that, Don Moeller's son, Jeff Moeller, did an incredible segment with me at the beginning of the pandemic. You can find that out in the buyatoyota.com audio vault, as well as all of the Moeller and Gary closing deals, selling homes, doing it virtually, doing it clean. And Don, I want to give you the honor because I know Ron Cassie a little bit. I obviously am a Baltimore Magazine admirer. At some point when I dust through, I'm going to find my best of Baltimore Magazine thing and hang it here somewhere from 1990, whenever it was. But I know you go way back as well, and you're really the genesis of this segment, which, and I saw it with my gloves and my mask on, Baltimore Magazine, How to Fix Baltimore. So I'll let you pick it up, Don.
Yeah, no, I appreciate Ron joining us, and Ron and I did go way back to his patch days when he was writing about county government, and I was out there for 20 some years, so we do have a history. And I texted Ron right away when my Baltimore Magazine arrived, I don't know, 2 weeks ago or whenever it was, that it actually arrived in the mail. And I texted you as well, and I said, boy, this is a terrific piece of journalism, Ron, and not to blow smoke at you, but it's the kind of piece that I think we used to get in Baltimore Magazine, really in-depth look at a really complicated issue. So we're delighted that you're joining us and coming on and talk about how to fix Baltimore.
Oh, thanks so much, Don, and thanks so much, Nestor. I really appreciate the opportunity to come out and talk about the story. And, this is our cover story. And, 5 years after the death of Freddie Gray, I think, the Healthy Holly scandal and everything else in Baltimore, we wanted to step back and take a big look at Baltimore, deep look back, look forward, and really pull forth some bold ideas to move this city forward in this century.
Well, let's start with that. You said bold ideas. I was going to say big ideas, right? Like big, bold, same thing, I guess, right? This is really what lured a baseball team to stay and a football team to come and an aquarium to be built and a science center that I invested in when I bought my condo 17 years ago, thinking, well, these anchor things and the convention center and there's Ruth's Chris and, there's Harbor Place and, hey, Under Armour's coming on the other end and look at all that Patarakis money and the H&S Bakery money, Harbor East, so we're going to be a little Hong Kong here. That's what I sold my wife on in 2003 when we met, fell in love, and I proposed to her at the top of Federal Hill, right? So big ideas, and, I guess the IRL was a big idea, or, that's a sports thing, and that goes back to my sports side. But big ideas aren't as big when you can't fix the schools, you can't fix the crime, you can't get the gangs in jail, you can't, when folks come out of prison, what's going on, and what crime and the tax base has done here. So big ideas, man. Let's start at the top, which is city and county government and the problem of flight from the city that, maybe Baltimore Positive would not. I always say Don says it's hard news, or Don says it's PR. I say it's hard news. Somewhere in the middle is the reality of the tax base and things that were done for businesses and hospitals and institutions that, from a tax base, really, really handicaps the city. There really is less money and less infrastructure to create money right now.
Yeah, so let's talk about that. The overall overarching idea of this story is that Baltimore City hasn't shrank. It has just failed to expand its natural boundaries. Right? Baltimore City, if we look at it, 80 square miles is very small compared to major cities in the United States. the San Diegos, all these cities that we think of growing, the Dallases, the Albuquerques, these are cities that are not 80 square miles, they're 350 square miles. If you would put Baltimore City and the county, the entire county, all the way to the Pennsylvania line together, it would still be fewer square miles than Jacksonville, Florida. So just to give a little bit of history, because I think in order to look forward, we need to look back. And I don't mean just to repeat the past, but to give us a really broad vision of what the city's problems are and how to move forward.
So you're preaching Don's language as a history teacher, right, Don?
Well, absolutely. And what I was struck by, and Ron leads with it, you know, you didn't bury the lead, Ron, in this story. You lead, and I'm going to ask you to really walk our listeners through. Nestor and I are going to kick back and put our feet up and listen as you walk us through the history of this thing, because you started with a parade in Hamden to celebrate the annexation of Hamden and Woodbury in 1948, and then you talk a few months later about probably one of the most consequential election referendum ever to be on the ballot in the state, a constitutional amendment. So really, walk us back to 48, take us to that parade, and then tell us why.
And I think a lot of people don't know this history. So this is, right. I would say this, this is the first time it's ever been told on my airwaves in 30 years of doing sports radio or any, literally, you know, I know sort of vaguely the story, but I could never tell it, you know, without reading it or really hearing it the way you reported it.
Great. So what I want to say too, is, and I know Donald will understand this as a history buff, this is not history as we think of history. You know, let's understand that, Lester, I know where you're from. I live in Highlandtown. You go Highlandtown, Bayview, Dundalk. Where exactly is the line there, and why does it make sense? Do you know what I mean?
I've always known, right? So, like, as a Baltimorean, if you had a 633 phone number, which my mother had on Kane Street or El Reno Street and Drew Street, where my friends like Mark Carroll Kasky lived, they were the city kids. The county line happened somewhere in Eastwood, right across in Blackwell, where the number 23 bus dropped off. And, you know, I knew that as a six-year-old kid because I took buses.
Right,
it cost 10 cents more to go into
the
county.
The cars, you have friends on both sides. This is essentially an artificial line for all intents and purposes. There's no river that you cross. There's no mountain range that you cross. Certainly, Highlandtown Bayview is more closely connected to Dundalk than Arbutus is, right? Or even Towson is. I mean, these are our neighbors.
Ron, before you continue that story, and I promise Nestor and I are going to shut up and let you give us the history lesson, but I don't know if you probably do because you researched it. Nestor may not know. We have houses in the county that pay half of their real estate taxes to Baltimore County and half of their taxes to Baltimore City because the line runs right through their property line.
Right. So if I can do one thing in this podcast, is to get the idea out there, have people imagine that the city and county are one entity, because in reality, they are. I mean, they ought to be. That this is an artificial distinction. You know, they're starting to think, you know, bold ideas, imaginatively. We all travel a little bit. If you're on the West Coast, or even if you're in Florida or Europe and you run into somebody, they say, oh, where are you from? You say Baltimore. And you say, oh, I'm from Baltimore too. And they'll say, whereabouts? And somebody will say, oh, Towson, Dundalk, Pikeville, Bel Air. They don't necessarily mean the city. So we are all in this together. That's the one thing, the big overarching picture. To get to the lead of the story and the parade, it was great to find this, but in 1948, Hamden Woodbury organized a three-day celebration. It's the 60th anniversary of their annexation into Baltimore City. This is a huge moment of civic pride that Hamden and Woodbury are celebrating their being annexed into the city. I mean, today, obviously, we could not imagine the city without Hamden is one of its neighborhoods or Woodbury today. And that's they're actually annexed in like 1888, and a big annexation happens then. The last annexation of the city is 1918. And it, the city adds doubles in size, more than doubles in size in 1918.
In the middle of the Spanish flu, too. I did the history on this.
Right. A lot of things 100 years ago were still, you know, the history's never passed, right, the history. But reason that that's important, right, is this was streetcar-induced sprawl that was causing people and businesses to leave the existing, which is only like 30 square miles, Baltimore City at the time, to push beyond those boundaries. I mean, Hausner's used to be the city-county line. So a lot of these neighborhoods, the Mount Washington, the Violetvilles, the Howard Parks, all these were not Laurelvilles, were not part of the city. And it was streetcar-induced sprawl that the city was looking to capture naturally as populations, businesses grow. All throughout history, they continue to expand beyond city-county lines all across the country. Baltimore City is actually not unique, right? And so when we think of white flight, the automobile, post-World War II, 1948, the same thing is happening. It's not streetcar-induced sprawl. It's automobile-induced sprawl. And Nestor, I know you'll remember the trolley that used to go all the way to North Point State Park, right? I mean,
The trolley tracks were in front of our house. It's somehow my dad got everywhere, right? I mean, they still had trolley tracks down here a few years ago before they built 414 Light. My wife would see them, and they would be on Key Highway as well around the corner by the Science Center. So it wasn't hard to at least get a piece of that. Ron Cassie is our guest. How to Fix Baltimore is the story and the history of Baltimore and where this line is. And I guess, Don, you can pick this up because you're a little older than me, a senior Don. When the Beltway came, right? I mean, it's how Catonsville became a suburb instead of like being part of the city, right?
Well, and again, give people perspective because our listeners are all around. A lot of our listeners certainly come from the West Side. They remember, I mean, I went to Mount St. Joe and we took the number 8 streetcar.
Right, number 8 streetcar, right.
Number 8 streetcar right down to Mount St. Joe. It would come up here to the junction. So, and again, I think, you know, I lived... My first home as a young married guy was in a little community called Westtown. Literally, again, one of those communities that on one side of the street is Baltimore County. The other side of the street is Baltimore City. What you asked earlier, Ron, what sense does it make that there's a dividing line that as I go down Frederick Road, suddenly the quality of the street changes a little bit as I enter Beachfield? I know that I'm in the city, but other than that, there's no rhyme or reason that I go from Catonsville into Beachfield, into Irvington, that there's some kind of an artificial line there that makes those places different.
And to your point on it, and I think you bring up a great that the Catonsville and Towson also had a streetcar. These were the first in Dundalk, the first inner rings suburban towns, if you will, but they were not. Just focus on the language. They're not really suburban towns. They're really just natural extensions. As Baltimore had moved, Charles Village used to be a suburb. Highland Town used to be a suburb. It's a natural process. But when you cut off a boundary like this in the schools and the property taxes and things like that, those lines get hardened. You know, there's enormous consequences. And, for example, you mentioned Beachfield, which suffers from tremendous, and I'm hearing it rain outside, tremendous flooding. The same downpours that destroyed Ellicott City leveled Beachfield. And there's hundreds of homes there whose basements were ruined, whose first floors were ruined. And these are folks who do not have a lot of money to come back to repair their households after tremendous damage in Beachfield. They had massive flooding. People lost major appliances. Still suffering there. The city doesn't have the wherewithal, the revenue anymore to do the infrastructure kind of fixes like Beachfield who require to handle more harder rainfalls today.
Well, Ron, talk about that. So we've got this parade. We're celebrating the annexation of Hamden and Woodbury. And then a few months later, as you say, under the radar, there is this constitutional amendment on the ballot that really got very little attention that ends up having incredible consequences. Tell our listeners about that referendum, what it was about, and how it passed.
Thanks, Don. Thanks for keeping me focused as well. 1948 referendum. So this is the Dewey Truman presidential election year, right? There's a lot of things happening. There's something like 32 or 33 questions on the ballot for voters, one of which is funding for Memorial Stadium, which, and a lot of these questions are getting a lot more attention than this referendum about the annexation referendum that a Baltimore County state senator who had a brief political career, really, but was always involved in Baltimore County Democratic politics, kind of, I won't say sneaks, but gets this referendum on the ballot that requires that before a jurisdiction, Baltimore City, can annex more land, the people who live on that property have to agree to it, that annexation. And it sounds innocuous enough, but the reality is, and certainly the Baltimore County political powers that be knew exactly what they were doing. They were trying to draw that hard line around Baltimore City that had been set since 1918 and just solidify it in concrete. And that's what they did. The ballot barely passed. And I want to say, I would love to take a further deep dive into this. Baltimore City overwhelmingly voted against this ballot annexation referendum that would seal its borders to this day, seal our borders to its day in Baltimore City. By like a 3-to-1 margin, Baltimore City voters voted against. The rest of the state, on the statewide ballot referendum, the rest of the voters in the state are basically agnostic. It's a wash, about 50-50 in the rest of the state. Baltimore County voters, which have a remarkable 93% turnout that year.
I read that, Ron. I got to tell you, I read that. I actually read it twice in your article, probably three times. And I thought, no. something was amiss. I don't care.
Now,
93%. Now, did you look at voter turnout in other elections? I'm curious, because that was my thought.
I did. You know, I spend way too much time diving through old archives of the Baltimore Sun and Maryland Historical Society. And, yeah, it had been in the 60s before that. Voter turnout was higher in those days. It had been in the 60s. You know, it was a good turnout by today's number. Nowhere near the 93% turnout that it was that year.
Well, don't get me started on corruption. I mean, that's, you know, that's how the whole platform began. That's why we're all sitting around here with masks on, right? So.
Yeah, so and the Baltimore County voters, by this 5-to-1 margin, and vote in favor of preventing the city from annexing any more county land. And to be clear, that is the difference. It overrides the vote in the city. The populations are in the county is still slightly smaller than the city at this point. It's enough to override the city-county margin. And yes, there were claims that Baltimore County was working Democratic powers that be, was working really hard to generate a big turnout. 93%, very suspicious. It may require some more digging at some point.
Well, and then you point out, Ron, who was the state senator? Do you remember?
I meant to look up his name again. I had a name, and I lost his name.
I'd like to know when you get a chance. If you just let, I'd be curious. I'd be curious which part of the county and which state senator, because you then go on, and part of the history of this is so important. And I'll preface this by saying that one of the things that all of us, you know, Dutch, Jim Smith, Kevin Cameron, myself, every one of us, we tend to. In our remarks, in our prepared remarks, we like to say to folks that Baltimore County today is actually larger in population than four states. I mean, it's larger than, you know, Wyoming, Vermont, Alaska, North Dakota. I mean, that's remarkable. We're going to have in the next census about, given the numbers that I'm looking at, we may have almost 300,000 more citizens, more residents than Baltimore City. And as you point out, and you can pick it up from there, that the referendum passes in 48, and 2 years later in 1950, the city population reaches a point that it never reached again.
You know, exactly. And I'm really glad you bring that up. And I'm not trying to harp anybody's language, but when we say the county versus the city, we have to understand that you know, people are crossing an artificial line, and the county is not really so distinct, right? If we can imagine, that's the idea. Imagine this is all one, right? And even the broader metro region as all one. The city and county were to merge, Baltimore City would be essentially the sixth or seventh largest city in the country. So let's think about that, how Baltimore is derided, the city's losing population, you know, bad press and all that stuff. If it was one, Baltimore City would be essentially in county the size of like a Phoenix, Philadelphia. You know, Phoenix has 517 square miles. You know, Houston's like 600 and some. San Antonio, 460 square miles. If just Baltimore City and the county together, in the public's imagination, the country's imagination would be seen much, much differently than we are today.
By the way, the senator's name was William P. Bolton. I looked that up for you. Magazine piece written by Jim Duffy, who was once wrote about me. So I appreciate Jim Duffy, the great Jim Duffy.
And I don't want to put all the blame at Senator Bolton's feet, because from what I understand that he had a relatively short legislative career, and it was the powers that be in the Baltimore County Democratic political machine that were really operating behind the scenes to get this on the ballot and to get him to write this on the ballot. He was not an influential senator in Annapolis.
Don Mohler is here, former Baltimore County executive. We're discussing all things BMAG and the cover story, which is really sort of the genesis of what we do here at Baltimore Positive, which is how to fix Baltimore. Ron Cassie is a senior editor at BMAG. You can find his work at Baltimore Magazine and covering Baltimore. Right. So ideas and big ideas off of the history. If we could merge that, we'd have a better tax base. Okay, you got another half dozen ideas here. Knocking down 83 at the city line at Penn Station. The big bullet train idea of maglev, of being able to get from Penn Station here to Union Station in 15 minutes in D.C. I'm a big proponent of all of that. Infrastructure, water, all of these things, above and beyond what is just your general mayor's platform, right? Crime and policing, economic development, education, health, infrastructure, all these things. But these are specific sort of big idea things that would... We had Barbara Mikulski on in the first episodes a year ago, and we're about to do episode 200 right now, Ron, and she told us a story about how Fort McHenry Tunnel was built and how it was supposed to run through Canton, you know, pretty much the way I-83 runs on top of the world through the city. These are some really bold ideas, and I don't know whether they're your ideas or ideas that you've heard bandied about, but go ahead and take these one by one and at least briefly and go through them, because big ideas, these are all really big ideas, each and every one of them.
So I aggregate, right? I'm a big reader and big aggregator, and I've tried to call, and I've been reporting in the Baltimore Magazine for a decade on the city, and a little bit of an urbanism wonk about stuff. But
I appreciate your passion, my man. Wait, so does Don. You know, cost me an hour and a half of reading this stuff over the weekend.
So you'll appreciate this, Nestor. I-83, during the pregame broadcast of Game 3 of the World Series in 1989, there was an earthquake in San Francisco, right? It knocks down essentially their 83, if you will. And people are dismayed. You know, what's going to happen? We need this. It turns out that not rebuilding was the genius idea, not rebuilding their 83. Instead, they built a walkable civic boulevard that brought a lot of pedestrian traffic, a lot of business traffic, and generated a lot of commercial activity and investment instead of having this. So if we think of the JFX lowering it from, say, Penn Station all the way into Harbor East and creating a big civic tree-lined boulevard, it doesn't just create investment. I mean, the traffic there, as everybody knows, doesn't move very fast anymore anyhow in that stretch, right? But it serves as a really enormous concrete barrier between downtown, between City Hall and East Baltimore.
Well, and specifically the hospital area that's exploded, and you know, and having traversed that many, many nights when my wife was battling over at Hopkins, right? Mm. The area from where the bridge is at, let's say Tio Pepe, down to the hospital, that whole area through where Dunbar is, that area there would have to become the next area that there that improves, just flat out improves, right?
Yeah, so if we can knock down this, you know, elevated archaic section of I-83, we develop a lot of, you know, commercial investment, residential investment, and just open up the sunlight, you know, to a big city tree-lined boulevard. You can even imagine a light rail going through there someday. It's a main artery.
And look at all the space we'll have once Trump gets rid of the post office, right? We won't need that anymore, right? I have to laugh or I would cry, Ron.
I just got a letter from the IRS through the post office with Donald Trump's signature about my...
There you go.
Well, I was too busy online buying the special presidential coin to commemorate COVID.
Well, Ron, you gave some examples, some exciting examples in your piece. You talk about the success in San Francisco. You talk about 14th Street in New York. Maybe share some of the examples with folks.
Right. So as far as like knocking down I-83 or that part of the JFX, right, it's happened in Boston or I-83. It's happened in Milwaukee. It's happening in cities around the country, this lowering of these urban highways.
Because it was built 80 years ago doesn't mean it was a good idea, right?
Right. Or the time has moved on, right? I mean, and the fact that if we can build these things, we can take them down. These are not impossible tasks. Certainly Barbara Mikulski would put forth. So yes, so another idea is creating more car-free streets. And this is somewhat counterintuitive, but it lowers congestion when you create spaces for people to walk, to ride their bike, to create just, you know, essentially thoroughfares for buses. 14th Street in New York City, a major east-west thoroughfare, was closed to private automobile traffic in November, and it's been nicknamed there the Miracle on 14th Street. We've also seen it, anybody who's been in New York recently knows, Times Square is closed to traffic. People were thought this would be impossible to achieve in New York City. Instead, it's a big, urban walkway, park, pedestrian area. And these things are done in cities, more cities all across the country, all across the world. If we can imagine a Fells Point closed to traffic on the weekends, a couple streets, a Harbor East, or even Charles Street on a Sunday. We open up to the kind of activity that people would see in the Howard Street, Lexington corridor in the heyday of the shopping district there. I mean, that's what you're trying to achieve in the city, is not to have everybody driving around their own 2,000-pound metal glass automobile, but to get out on their feet with their families, walking, maybe riding a bike, taking a bus, used to take trolleys, things like that. That's not a hard fix, to be honest. That's been tried and been proven to be really successful in other cities. San Francisco, their Market Street there is like our Charles Street, and in November they just closed that to private automobile traffic.
Well, I tell you what, Ron, at some point we will have you back. I mean, we're 30 minutes deep into this. We could probably go on all day about the Red Line and about, where we are on crime and education and rec centers and a metro government, which several of the current candidates and TJ Smith and Brandon Scott are going to come on Baltimore Magazine or Baltimore Positive next week as Ron Cassie from Baltimore Magazine is our guest. One thing I do want to talk about is the maglev, because that doesn't get written about a lot. We write about crime all the time. We write about MetroGov. We're going to talk about that. But the maglev was the big idea that when I've been in Hong Kong, when I was in Tokyo 5 months ago, when I see what Baltimore is, and we have to accept where we are in 2020, which to your point, we aren't Philadelphia, we aren't New York, we're not Washington, D.C. They've gotten ahead of us. The one thing we could do to become a part of that is become really connected to that, because the port is here. All of these institutions and medical, and we're talking about cyber now down at Port Covington. The way to be cool is to get out in front of all of this, the way Governor Schaefer got out in front of urban development. Baltimore Baltimore was the urban development back in the 1980s because we developed something that he had seen in a magazine somewhere in Europe and said, let's do that here. I've been to Asia. I've seen what this means, and I know what it would do for Baltimore 15 or 20 years from now for Don's beautiful grandchild who's trying to go off to Roanoke, and we don't want to lose her. We want to bring her back to Baltimore, right? And part of that is Baltimore is hip and cool. It's the place the people that like hang out in Philly and D.C. want to live because it's a neighborhood, awesome place with a harbor and water and these natural resources and all these great things. But it has to be safe, education, all of that. But the big idea is it needs to be a part of the party, man. You know, it can't be Camden, New Jersey. It can't be the other place. It has to be the place, you know?
So if I can, I'll take just maybe like two quick steps to get to Maglev. And one is what you bring up about a little bit earlier about creating a metro government. Kansas City, Kansas is growing. Just recently consolidated 1997 with Wyandotte County.
We had a president that thought that's where the football team, but it's a whole, we'll get into that. That's
right,
a third segment.
Well, speaking about football, if you remember when we lost, Nestor, the getting a pro football team to Jacksonville, right?
And Charlotte.
Right? Mm-hmm. What do those cities have in common? They are consolidated with their counties and growing. The NFL could see that. They did economic reports. They could see that these were booming regions. Baltimore is not, and it was not going to grow. So a great Dean Rusk, a guy who wrote Cities Without Suburbs, actually did the economic planning for Charlotte to make their pitch. I think it was Richardson was their general manager, a former Baltimore guy. He did their pitch to the NFL. He showed that these areas are growing. You know, Boston is part of Suffolk County, right? San Francisco is part of San Francisco County. So these, Nashville is part of its county. These are the areas that are growing in the country. And I bring this up because they also allow the school systems to desegregate somewhat, to blur those lines. The schools are not so hyper-segregated with low-income minority neighborhoods. These are important things for attracting new residents, right? The Maglev is important for a number of reasons. As you know, we are woefully behind, not just in Baltimore, but in Maryland, but in the country, behind other places in terms of mass transit. The Maglev is important, and we're seeing this with COVID, that many people can work from home today. Baltimore is uniquely situated between D.C., Philadelphia, New York, wonderful resources like the Chesapeake Bay, the Inner Harbor. People can work from home. Many people today can commute to D.C. or commute to New York once a week, and they're good. If you have a train, it would make that an hour trip to New York would spur a lot of economic development. If I can digress.
Not to mention Don and Linda going to a lot more of a chorus line as well.
That's right.
Yeah, exactly. You can whatever you want to do. You know, you can go see the Orioles play the Yankees in Yankee Stadium if you want. Lots of attractions.
I just hope it's not the Nashville Orioles, Ron. You know, that's what I'm trying to make sure, you know?
Ron, the question about the Maglev, I think, becomes, does it become a toy for the upper class? In other words, is it possible to make something like one of the things that my good friend Kevin Kamenetz used to talk about, the reason he was so bullish on the Red Line, for example, and you write about the importance of starting the Red Line again, which I think is just one of the real, real mistakes that we've made in public policy in the state of Maryland was pulling the plug on the Red Line. But what he liked about the Red Line was he thought it was an opportunity to attract what he would always refer to as the choice rider, to get people who don't necessarily have to use public transportation, but who would be willing to put their car aside and say, this makes more sense. When you research and talk about the Maglev, is it possible to make it accessible to a wide group of demographics, or is it really become an upper-class toy?
All these questions are great. You're right. It is not for the masses. But I want to parse this out a little bit. The Red Line is more important and should come first. And it should not be either or. You know, one of these bold ideas, this seems to be all of the above. Look how we're addressing this COVID crisis. This seems to be an all of the above thing. So need the Red Line. As anybody knows, there's thousands of jobs at Social Security Administration. There's thousands of jobs at Bayview. There's thousands and thousands more at TradePoint Atlantic. have to be able to get across the city to these jobs. That's number one. Successful cities are not cities where people drive to work. They're cities where successful working people choose public transportation because it's the best, most efficient, most affordable option, right? The metro in D.C., the subway in New York. You will see Wall Street bankers in New York taking the subway to work. You will see professional baseball players taking the subway to New York. Everybody uses the metro in D.C. So you're absolutely right, Don. You need to have the red line needs to be built pronto. The maglev is a longer-term project. I will just digress, and it will outprice the average person. There is no doubt about that. But in all of the above approach, I'll just give you an example. Where I grew up in Allentown, Pennsylvania, was going through everything Dundalk and Baltimore went through when I was growing up there in the 70s.
Billy Joel wrote a song about it.
Billy Joel wrote a song about that was about the year I graduated high school. That's what I was, right. So, but there's Allentown, strangely, is even though it's an hour from Philadelphia, it's only an hour and a half by a new highway was built in 78 to New York City and became an hour and a half ride. There used to be a daily train from Allentown to New York City. A highway was built, and it started drawing commuters from New York and North Jersey to live in, not Allentown, downtown itself, mostly the suburban McMansionvilles around Lehigh, Northampton County. But when new houses are being built, I was a carpenter out of high school. Guys like me were framing houses. People are selling refrigerators. There's concrete workers laying the foundations. There's a lot of schools are getting new population, tax base is growing. And as maglev goes hand in hand as a remote, developing Baltimore as a remote city, attracting investment on that level, new property owners. And also, it ties into this overhaul that's happening at Penn Station. You know, Amtrak is putting in hundreds of millions of dollars into new development around Penn Station. Bill Strever and Cross Street Partners, a lot of developers are investing money there. And the maglev will connect to the Amtrak development. The Penn Station is a unique resource that can help link East Baltimore and West Baltimore together, break down some of those boundaries, spur investment in an area where it's still kind of been slow to coming. And maglev is part of that, an overall vision for a 21st century Baltimore. The NAACP got behind it, as I'm sure you know, Don, because it's projected to create 70,000 jobs, just the construction of the maglev. And so... it's not the answer for the workaday Baltimore. That's the red line. That's an improved Maryland bus transportation system, right?
But that was the other disappointing part, Ron, of the losing the red line, was not only the red line itself and its economic development impact in moving people from point A to point B, but also all of the centers that were going to, you could tell historically if you look, that would develop around the stops, all of the construction jobs, all of the secondary jobs that were going to be created. They were just like overnight, the plug was pulled on them. And that whole economic stimulus piece of the red line went away.
It's remarkable. And I know it continues to get brought up in Baltimore, but it just needs to get done. So there's no other way around it. And what you point to, the transit, the transit development that would get around all the stops at the red line, right? There'd be 22 stops between Bayview, Greektown, and Woodlawn. When these things are permanent, just like the metro stops in D.C., naturally attract investment that's critical. Tens of thousands of jobs obviously lost. I mean, the red line is really a pro business. I mean, mass transit is really pro business. Right, pro-economic development. That's fundamentally...
Well, and I think you see that if you've ever been on a subway anywhere in, like, the world, right? Like, literally, Asia, Europe, New York, anywhere you've been, you see what the possibilities are for it and how it moves people around, which, I want to move to the road to nowhere while we're on transportation and where we are, because you talk about connecting Woodlawn to East Baltimore. Ron, I don't know if you know, I grew up in East Baltimore. My dad never had a car. We took the number 23 bus literally everywhere we ever went. So, connecting east to west and coming downtown and talking about old wrestling matches with Ron Snyder or old Memorial Stadium memories with Don Mohler. The way I got to all of those places was on a bus, so, yeah. And knowing the value of that. And when the buses were on time, and it's the way my dad got to work every day of his life, that when you don't have that transportation, I think that's really, really hard for someone that once had a flat tire in 2003 and they drive a late model vehicle from one of my great partners that sell cars, and they have those means. But when you don't have those means and you need a job, and we wonder what holds the city back, and we just want to put the television on and hold our nose and hold our, you put our hands over our eyes, that's not what we want to do here. And, you know, part of that really is what all of these problems have been widely identified, but the road to nowhere, you talk about all the sort of mind crimes that have been, perpetrated over the last 75 years from redlining and all of these awful things that have happened. That one was right up there to do a civic project that did no one any good, right?
Yeah, I'll just, amplify what you said. I first moved to Baltimore. I lived in Waverly. I stayed here because I could walk to Memorial Stadium, and I could take the bus up to Towson University where I was going to school. I live in a house in Highlandtown that was built in 1904, a row house. That predates the automobile. I mean, let's keep this in mind. These neighborhoods, Highlandtown, Canton, these are all before the automobile. People got around on trolleys, on horseback. I mean, there is not room for everybody to drive a car in a city like downtown city like Baltimore. The road to nowhere, was the idea, of course, to build. It was stopped. It was to connect essentially the Beltway, I-70, all the way down through the heart of the city to Fells Point. Barbara Mikulski, late 60s, a civic activist, gets together with Black residential community associations in Rosemont to stop the road to nowhere, which essentially is the massive highway that comes to a halt when you get to Martin Luther King Boulevard. Comes in, it's essentially supposed to be kind of like Route 40. But we have to reimagine what we can do with that. The damage has been done. It's in some ways, it's like the JFX. It's a massive concrete barrier between neighborhoods in the city that isolates people. The red line was designed to go through there out to Woodlawn. You can imagine a light rail system going through there, environmental landscaping, commercial investment all around there, a park, right, like the High Line Park in New York, but actually much, much larger, that would attract, families, become an amenity to people of Baltimore City, not this massive scar that has been there for, six plus decades at this point.
Well, Dan Rodericks, a friend of all of us, has written a number of times that his idea of really greening up that road to nowhere, making it really a massive breeding area and making it, there are many, many ideas out there.
And all of them are better than what they have, right?
Correct. And I think that's the exciting thing, Ron, about your piece. You're saying to people, let's not throw in the towel. This is what Baltimore Positive is all about. Let's make this thing better. And there are some ideas out there. And you resurrect one that I think people remember pretty fondly, and that is the $1 houses, the investment looking for folks who want to turn a neighborhood around and come in and take a house for a dollar and create a new neighborhood. And you think that's viable again?
It is. And I'll just say this. There are a lot of ideas. Sometimes, there's a saying in Baltimore that we have, corruption masquerading as incompetence in Baltimore. I'm not sure, but we need leadership that will generate the political will to make things happen, right? The Schaefers, the Mikulskis, that really pushed the ball forward. The Dollar House program was actually Able Foundation President Robert Embry's brainchild, if you will. Schaefer knew a good idea when he heard it, or he was willing to try ideas, right? Certainly. And what I talked to Mary Pat Clark extensively about this. She's tried to get, she got a resolution passed for the city to take a look at this again. She's been pushing this really hard with some local community associations. And, what she said, the problem is essentially the city has trouble identifying currently groups of houses together. What you really need for the Dollar House program to flourish is a half a block,
correct,
a corner of row houses together where a group of people can be identified. And what they really need is the down payment, and what their money would go for, their investment would be in rehabbing the home. So rather than putting $20,000 as your mortgage down, the city gives you the house for a dollar. That $20,000 goes towards a loan towards rebuilding, rehabbing a house. So the city gets investment, people get a home, but you need like and this was really effective. Otterbein is often mentioned, which is a quintessential turning point, but this was also done in Federal Hill, in Fells Point, in Pigtown, in Butcher's Hill, in Ridgely's Delight. And, you know, we can see Butcher's Hill, Ridgely's Delight, Federal Hill, Fells Point is really successful today. And Don, I think you're old enough, but Federal Hill does not always look like Federal Hill today.
Correct.
And South Baltimore did not always look like South Baltimore.
Yeah, the picture out my bread box window of Otterbein is not what Otterbein looked like in the days where the fish market was across the street, right?
There were Federal Hill houses, partly because these urban highways that were planned to destroy Federal Hill and Fells Point, that Mikulski and others stopped, the city bought up a ton of blighted properties, fenced them in, and had no idea what to do with them before the Stoller housing program. So it has worked before, but I think one of the ideas of this big story is that we have to find a way to start tackling these things all at once, right? Part of the idea of creating a metro government is in conjunction with Carroll, Hartford, Anne Arundel County, even Queen Anne, is that we're all one region. And we need to operate as such. We see that with COVID or globalization, working in isolation is not effective. And if we can lower the property taxes, right? Baltimore City pays exponentially more in property taxes, city homeowners.
It's almost a punishment, right? Like literally,
it's
right?
Almost a punishment. So,
take that example, Ron, and that's, I'll give you an example I'm very familiar with, is that if you come over to the west side, and Nestor's been making a few trips over here now. If people are very familiar with a lot of the larger Catonsville homes, many of them were summer homes, actually, for city residents who lived in Irvington and other areas. They would come summer in Catonsville. But if you go down...
I summer in Catonsville. I got to put my chair out on the 4th of July.
If you go down Edmonton Avenue in Catonsville towards the city, you come to a group of homes in Ten Hills and Hunting Ridge. And those homes, again, you talk about the artificial lines, Ron, which is it's so glaring when I think of communities nearby where I live, is that my son, who is a realtor, would tell you that a big, gorgeous home in Ten Hills is literally $200,000 to $250,000 less than it would be if it were a mile and a half west of where it is, simply because it's in the city and the property tax rate and the other things that go with the city. So the economic impact of what you describe as these artificial lines is significant.
Well, you bring up, I wish everybody would just, go to those neighborhoods, take a drive through sometime next time you're out that way, and look at those homes in Ten Hills and Hunting Ridge, other neighborhoods in West Baltimore. They're gorgeous single-family homes in leafy neighborhoods that, like you said, anywhere else would be worth $200,000 more. The idea of one of the ideas of creating a metro government is not just for planning, but we could spread the property tax out, right? The surrounding counties where people work in Baltimore City, where or at least a family member does, where they attend entertainment events, sporting events, everything else, the economic engine around the port. There could be a regional property tax assessed that would help alleviate this burden on Baltimore City, and if you will, blend that line a little bit, that unfair burden that Baltimore City residents pay. And I want to say that this is also in people in Baltimore County, Howard County, self-interest to do this, right? Nobody is going to succeed. The region is not going to succeed long-term if Baltimore City doesn't, right? So we already see, I think, Don, some of the problems in Baltimore County. It's taken decades longer maybe than folks maybe hit worst case scenarios in the 90s. But things like the crime rate and poverty rate in Baltimore in the county is going up. So you can't, just as we see issues in Prince George's County around D.C., if the burden is spread out, if these lines are blurred, it becomes much more manageable to tackle all these problems. Suddenly you're not relying on a gimmick to keep people in Baltimore City. the property tax isn't as onerous as it used to be.
Well, and then the other part of this is the people who do live in Harford County or Hereford or Westminster, who at some point in their life put on a purple hat or an orange hat and came downtown and had a crab cake and said, I love old Ballmer, and don't you talk bad about my town, I'll kick your ass. Yeah, you know, all that. That's gone away now because they feel like it's, oh, that's Nestor's problem because he lives in the city. That's, you know what I mean? That's Baltimore's problem. I'm not a part of that. I live in the county. That's the city. We need to take that away and make Baltimore attractive for everyone to feel a part of it again.
But you bring up a great point, Nestor. A great, great point. I mean, I think that's part, again, just to go back to story. That's one of the ideas behind this story there's a psychology that's grown over the decades. That Baltimore City is this. Baltimore County is this, Harford County is that. A line of demarcation has taken place in our mindset. That's not our problem. It's those people, that kind of thing, which is really, you know, unfortunate, disingenuous, harmful, and it really doesn't benefit
them,
people, no matter where they live.
Right. No doubt. It's costing you up in Cecil County that Baltimore's not as strong as it could be, because if Baltimore was as strong as it could be, we could make Cecil County better too, right? So, you know, Ron, we could go on all night, and we would, and we could, and we do at Baltimore Positive, and you can at Baltimore Magazine. Ron Cassidy is here, senior editor of BMAG. Ron, we are definitely going to bring you back on the backside of the election and everything that's going on around here. And I know, you know, I'm very appreciative of everything you and Teitelbaum, Max, everybody. I love them all over there for sending the piece over. And we'll continue to see this thing through. We're all in it together, brother, right?
Absolutely. Thanks so much for the opportunity, and great to reconnect with Don as well.
Well, it's just outstanding. As I said to Nestor as soon as I read it, it's outstanding journalism. To all of our listeners, if you haven't gotten yet a copy of the latest Baltimore magazine, How to Fix Baltimore, Ron Cassidy, you won't want to miss it. It's thought-provoking. These are the kinds of discussions that we need to be having. So, Ron, thanks so much. That's to take us out of here.
Man, perfect, perfect. Exactly where we need to be. Make sure you go out and pick up that BMAG as well. I brought my Preakness jacket out for Ron. He can't see it on the camera, but I tried anyway. Nasty at WNST.net finds me. We've been merging the brands. WNST with, obviously, sports is what we've done here for three decades. We started the Baltimore Positive journey a little over a year ago now, 200 episodes deep. Don and I doing our 200th episode this week remotely, and we might even use Zoom. I got Don a really cool microphone we're going to play with around here. Technology in the former Baltimore County executive. Throw me an email. I'm out on Facebook and Twitter and LinkedIn and Snapchat. Big thanks to all of our sponsors at State Fair in Catonsville, where I am missing everything about sitting underneath the Kurt Cobain and Joan Jett poster and doing things with Don. And by the time I get back over there, I don't know, maybe you'll have Mick and Keith back on the walls. I don't know. Big thanks to Evan, who's opening a Mexican restaurant. So I see fajitas and margaritas in my future on Frederick Road. That's more time in Catonsville. I'll be summering in Catonsville with the Molars this summer, and of course with State Fair. Fadley's, shipping crab cakes everywhere you are. You're paying attention to this. You love Baltimore. You love crab cakes. There's no finer crab cake than Fadley's. They ship them. One click. And they'll summer it out to Catonsville for you. If you're with the Mollers, I'm going to stop by and get some mac and cheese soon and curbside that up. Also, Moeller and Gary Realty did a long-form conversation with Jeff Moeller last month. You can find that out in the buyatoyota.com audio vault as well. I've been shaving and cleaning up, keeping my freedom patch going here. I didn't want to do the playoff beard. It was getting a little itchy and didn't dress me up nice for the mayoral season. As we have all the mayor candidates next week. We've had arts week. We've had education, chancellors, leaders. It's what we're doing around here these days. I am Nestor. He is Don Moeller. We are WNST.net, keeping calm, staying local, and always Baltimore Positive.